morning, agus polchestia. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. On this week's This Irish American Life, I am delighted to welcome Jeffrey Cobb, Jeff as I refer to him. Jeff is actually someone I know a little bit because we have shared a locality in Brooklyn as a place of residence for a number of years. But today I'm speaking to Jeff with his kind of hat from the New York Irish History Roundtable, for which Jeff is the Vice President for Local History. Many of you listening this morning will be familiar with how important and how great the work of the New York Irish History Roundtable is. And they do a number of different things. Some of them I'm going to speak to Jeffrey about today. But Jeff, in his own right, has done amazing work and continues to do amazing research and writing and publication of areas of New York history and New York Irish history in particular. First of all, Jeff, welcome back to the show, and wonderful to reconnect with you today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to a neighbour, fellow Irish woman.
Well, my pleasure too, and I'm grateful to Dr. Linda Dowling-Almeida, my fabulous colleague and friend, actually, and Linda is involved in the New York Irish History Roundtable as well, for putting us together in terms of this chat, Jeff. So I suppose I'm hoping that you let me meander through. I always like catching up with you because you're always doing different projects and topics that are so interesting to me, because I've similar interests to you in terms of Irish history and the New York history, which, and some of those overlap, of course, and you always do such a great job of uncovering some of these nuggets of hidden history. I suppose that as kind of point of order, our mission today is to chat about some of the work you've done recently in terms of the web presence for the New York Irish History Roundtable. Can you tell me about your involvement with this wonderful organization, Jeff, and then your work in terms of the website as well?
A few years ago, I worked for an Italian-American assistant principal, and she said, "You Irish can never just get to the facts. There's always, everything is a segue to the story." So, of course, I have to have a story for this. I guess I started writing columns for the New York Irish History Roundtable about 5 years ago. They had sort of traditional meetings where people would come, there would be a speaker, and there was a dwindling presence. So what I became more and more aware of, and I think speaking with some of the other members of the organization, that the traditional format that had served the organization since 1984 was increasingly not as effective. And I was speaking with another Irish neighbor from Turlough McConnell, and he said, "Well, why don't you apply for a grant to the Irish government to digitize the amazing collection of articles that the Roundtable presents in its journal. So since 1986, they put together a really amazing journal that unfortunately very, very few people, I felt, were able to access. You know, it was in libraries, or some people had private subscriptions, but especially scholars in Ireland or scholars in other cities really probably weren't aware of this. So I applied to the Irish government for a $2,500 grant. And, you know, any government is going to make you jump through a lot of hoops, because rightfully so, they want to make sure that their money is being well spent and that it's being tracked. And I have to give a shout out to Frank Naughton, who's one of the officers in the New York Irish History Roundtable, who was infinitely patient, producing the documentation, producing financial statements, and eventually helping us to get this. So finally, I finished the grant in February of 2021, and about 8 months later, I actually got the money. And I have to give another shout out to one of my other neighbors, Patrick Gilmore, who's a web developer from Belfast. I'm not very technically savvy, but Patrick is, and really for much below market rate, he really did the nuts and bolts of assembling the website, of downloading decades of articles. And finally, we cobbled this together and we have it up. So that now people around the world who are interested in the Irish in New York can access this really great collection of articles. And let me just give the address if anybody wants to check it out. It's nyirishhistory.us. And one of the things that's really great about this site is that it's a database, so it's searchable. So let's say your interest is Donegal. You can type in Donegal, and every article that's mentioned Donegal since 1986 is there. And just in my own research, I found that databases are invaluable because you find things that you never even knew were there. So I really encourage people, again, it's nyirishhistory.us. Go there and just explore the wealth of research that's been going on since the middle 1980s.
I was looking at the website, Jeff, and my gosh, it's such a great, lovely, clean design and so accessible. To your point, Jeff, I suppose, in terms of the origins of this project, and I'm really glad to have the opportunity to have myself a chat to you about this, because I so appreciate what the work behind all this and this great initiative, but also more generally to share it with a wider audience too, of course, with our listeners. I have had the good fortune to be knocking around NYU's Centre for Irish Studies for a number of years. So the copies of the New York Irish History Roundtable Journal were always pretty accessible. But I did, so I'm correct in thinking that heretofore, there wasn't a way to access any of the articles online. Is that correct?
You could buy them online, but here they're free. I think you would buy them and then they were sent to your email. But it, right. You know, it became an expensive proposition, because I believe that we're working on journal number 35. So if you wanted to download them all, it became expensive. But this is absolutely free, and it's a resource. So people can take advantage of it, you know.
It's wonderful. And as you say, the searchability of it in terms of the database functionality is just amazing. Would you, and now I know when I'd like if we can talk about some of your contributions to the journal and some of your work more recently as well. I'm happy to have an opportunity to catch up with you. How did the mechanics of it work for you, Jeff, in terms of like, what did you have to do in terms of making this happen? You mentioned that Patrick kind of did the magic in terms of that what we see now online, but what did you have to like kind of gather the materials together and stuff like that?
Yeah, that was a challenge. So essentially what we had to do is we had to buy back copies of all the journals that I didn't have and then digitize them. And then once they were digitized, it's quite easy to put them into the website and to create the browser so that they can be searched. That was one of the big challenges, to take them from sometimes a paper format or sometimes a CD-ROM format and to digitize them so that they could be uploaded onto the website. You know, I have to be honest, John Ridge is an amazing historian. Frank Norton is an amazing historian. None of us are really super tech savvy. So I think that was also part of the thing, is how to get somebody like Patrick who really knew how to make this happen. You know, again, I give him a shout out, because really he did it at very much, it was really kind of a sacrifice for him. If he had charged us at what he bills us normally at, we wouldn't have been able to do it. But I think he saw the value of the project and was very charitable.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful to see people coming together in that way. Can I ask you, Jeff, you said you've only been involved in the roundtable for the last 5 years or so, which is much shorter time period than you've been working on aspects of New York history and Irish history. How did that happen for you in terms of your involvement with the roundtable?
I think the last time we spoke in this forum, I was telling you about my research into Peter McGuinness, and I wrote a book about Peter McGuinness. For those of you who don't know the illustrious Peter McGuinness, sort of main thoroughfare in Greenpoint is McGuinness Boulevard, and he was this larger-than-life last Tammany Hall-style ward boss who ran this area. So I went and found his archive and did research and wrote a book about him, and then Frank Norton invited me to come to the round table and discuss an article that I published on McGuinness. It's sort of the start of the snowball from there. These men are getting older, and they said they wanted a younger presence on the advisory board. So they asked me to become the vice president for local history. I've continued to work with him, and it's, you know, these are people who are not going to be in the front of a parade, but I want to give a shout out to both of them again. John Ridge and Frank Norton have for decades put innumerable hours, put their passion and their heart and their dedication into making this New York Irish History Roundtable a reality. And I do invite people to check out the scholarship, because it really is excellent scholarship, but it's not dry. These are articles that are well read, they're readable. This is the passion of these two men. So I kind of alluded to this before, right as the pandemic was hitting, we realized that the way we had been doing things, or the way things have been done since 1986, just wasn't functioning. Fewer people were coming to in-person meetings. So I discussed this with them when I applied to the grant. For the grant, I think it's going to really revitalize what we do. The other thing I'd just like to mention as an aside is I did a presentation for a small historical society in South Armagh, and they're absolutely fascinated by the stories of people from Armagh or people from Ulster who've come to New York. But then a lot of times they're not aware of how to follow the story, what happened to these people. So I think as far as Irish researchers, this is really great, because again, you know, they can kind of put in a name and track, and a lot of times they'll find out what happened to these people, or they'll find out how their communities settled in New York. John Ridge is really has produced a number of excellent articles about different counties, where they settled and what they did in New York. So I encourage people to look at that, you know. But again, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, it's just, it's such an excellent resource. And you're able to access these articles, or you're able to access information in a way that you were not before. Because before, all right, you might have Journal 24, but you wouldn't be aware that there was a story in Journal 23 that you were interested in. So it's not just a great resource that's online. It's a great resource that's searchable in a way that it wasn't 2 years ago.
No, Jeff, and I absolutely won't get any complaints from me for praising Frank and John Ridge. They're saints. They're a saint and a scholar. Each of them really apply to both of them, and I've such respect for what they have done and continue to do in terms of. And your point is well taken in terms of having a resource for the Irish in Ireland that gives an accessible and just amazing catalogue and database of the ways in which Irish immigrants and their descendants have navigated New York City and its environs over a couple of hundred years. Because I think sometimes we, the Irish in Ireland, we have this perception of we know what Irish emigration, migration to the United States, to New York, what it looks like. And one of the things that this catalogue of articles shows us is the diversity of experiences within that category of Irish New Yorker. Can I ask you, Jeff, since we last spoke, and maybe I'll prompt you in a minute to reshare with us, because I know that what you're right, the last time we spoke on this forum was about your research on Peter McGuinness. What a fascinating figure. One of those, there are a few Irish place names in the Greenpoint, Brooklyn area. I'm thinking of Monsignor McGoldrick Park, Karen Park, the McGuinness Boulevard, as you mentioned. But since we last spoke, you published an article in, if I can go back to the New York Irish History Roundtable, on someone who I found extremely interesting, and that is Father Edward McGlynn, the Catholic priest. And you probably came to him, or did you come, how I came across him was in the context of Dr. Gertrude B. Kelly, which is maybe how you came, or is that how you came to him? No?
No, actually, I didn't. So let me explain or give a little bit of a background about Father McGlynn. Father McGlynn was a beloved pastor of a parish in Manhattan with many, many poor people. And increasingly, he became interested in social justice. And then he happened on the writings of Henry George, who basically said that the rich, there should be property taxes and that the rich should have to pay so that there's a more equitable society. Certain elements in the Catholic Church, basically Cardinal McCloskey, became enraged with this message. He was defrocked. It was a huge outroar because he was such a beloved priest and so many people identified with his message. Eventually, word got to Rome. Powers in Rome said, this message is not worthy of him being defrocked. And they came and they had a special hearing and he was reinstated as a priest. But one of his supporters was a man that I also wrote about in the New York Irish History Roundtable, Father Sylvester Malone, who was the priest almost for a half century in St. Peter and Paul in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were close friends and they shared this belief that society had to tax the rich so that it supported the poor. Yeah, so he's a really, really a fascinating figure. So it's funny, once you start researching, you come across these other stories. It becomes like a jigsaw puzzle.
And
I want to give one other shout out. When I wrote this article about Father McGlynn, I wanted to be very, very careful not to offend people's religious sensibilities. And one or two sentences that are phrased in the wrong way can offend people. So a Jesuit in Murray Weigel Hall, Father James Joyce, he reviewed the article and he looked at it and he said, maybe word this a little bit differently or word that. And I'm grateful to him for that because I really wanted to write something that was about a controversial topic, but didn't offend anybody's religious sensibilities. So. he helped me with that, and I'm grateful to him for that.
You know, what you're getting at there, Jeff, and the point you were making just there beforehand, like that idea of the jigsaw puzzle, another way of calling it is really the networks, the connections that people have in terms of Father Malone. I know that Gertrude B. Kelly is connected to McGlynn at some point in her life as well. And when you, the advantage of a biographical approach is that you are actually able to sometimes, not always, but, you know, because it's dependent on the sources that are left behind. And we don't always leave sources behind about our connections in that way. But sometimes we're able to piece together a little bit what is bringing people together under the rubric of Irishness or New York Irishness or their Catholic identities and stuff like that. These more radical individuals who have sometimes been a little bit overlooked in our narratives of Irish America, it's great to bring them back into dialogue, right, and into the light.
Well, it's funny because I think we could have an hour-long discussion about Gertrude Kelly. She's such a fascinating figure. I would always argue that she was kind of airbrushed out of a lot of Irish history because, I mean, she wasn't overtly Catholic. She was a radical socialist, you know, and a lot of her beliefs contradicted, let's say, the sort of dominant narrative of a woman's life was about getting married, was about being active in the church, was about raising your family in the church. So her experience was really, really different. But I tell you something ironic. I taught for many years in the museum school in Manhattan. And right next to the museum school is the Gertrude Kelly playground, which I walked through for a number of years and never realized that Gertrude Kelly was born in Carrick-on-Suir, Ireland. And this is one of the things that I find is really interesting about local history is you have no idea of streets you've walked down or playgrounds that you're familiar with, what history lies there. And obviously use the New York Irish History Roundtable as a start, but you can also use the New York Times. And if you're interested in digging, what you'd find out about the Irish history in the city will blow your mind, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I've come to learn in terms of delving into New York Irish history, and my journey was, Jeff, very much going to New York to study immigrants, that firstborn generation, ones like you and me, who still had the brogue, people who were in that first phase of kind of navigating New York as a city, as foreigners, right? But the longer I was in New York, and it just drew me in more and more intellectually in terms of that richness that you speak to. And there are, you know, I feel like, I don't know whether you agree with me, but I just feel like you could spend the rest of your life uncovering these threads. And that's not to take away from the scholarship that the likes of John Ridge knows a lot of New York Irish history. Marion Casey knows a lot of New York Irish history. Other scholars do as well. But that's almost my gauge. If you come across something and you ask one of the two of them, have you ever come across this person or this? And they say no. And it's like, there's a lot more there that we haven't actually got to at all because of the longevity and scale of Irish immigration to the city. And not everyone stayed connected to Irish networks in ways that would actually easily allow us to bring them into the historical narratives at times. Or, to your point, and I agree with you, perhaps because of whatever reason, and I take on board some of your points on Gertrude Kelly, because I agree with you that it didn't fit neatly into our narrative of the Irish American experience, and it was kind of overlooked a little bit. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I would also tell you that there's another strand of history that I find fascinating. The vast majority of Irish immigrants who came were the Catholic faith, but that was not all of the Irish immigrants that came. There were a huge number of Protestant immigrants who came from Ireland who made huge contributions. And yet somehow I think that a lot of their stories have been forgotten or are not properly told. And I'll give you a perfect example. This just floored me. I graduated from Hunter College, never realizing that Thomas Hunter was a fellow Ulsterman. I wrote an article for the New York Irish History Roundtable about Hunter. It's a fascinating journey. He was a Protestant Republican. He was a teacher, and when his Republican views were discovered in the late 1840s, he was basically told he had no future in Ireland, came to New York, and became a principal, became the first public school principal that said there will be no corporal punishment in my school. Probably could have been superintendent of the New York City Public Schools, but was so passionate about females getting educated that he set up, I believe it was called the New York Normal College at first, and it evolved into Hunter College, but it was a school to educate women, which was a huge risk. And that's an amazing story. And the other thing that I think is great is that Hunter was always non-sectarian. From the get-go, there were African-American female students there. There were Jewish students there. So this is a living and breathing institution that is part of the fabric, the DNA of New York. And that story is not really told, I think, in an Irish context.
Absolutely. I had no idea, Jeff, until I came across your research on Hunter. And, you know, that's such a great example because, like, Hunter College is, like, so New York as an institution. And, right. you know, another one you probably know of is, and, you know, this one, I mean, I used to think about it when I would pass by, but then I was a long-term member of the McBurney YMCA in Manhattan. And again, McBurney, whose name, I want to say Edward, but it may not be that.
I think it's Edward, yeah.
Yeah, is it? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my memory's better than I thought. Yeah. Edward McBurney was another Ulsterman and stuff like that. And it's again, you say the McBurney Y to people and it's such a New York. It's in the kind of the DNA of the city. But so many of these place names, and I suppose, you know, back to McGinnis Boulevard and Monsignor McGoldrick. And I think I mentioned to you maybe before, Jeff, either formally on this forum or more informally, I'll never forget the time I did an interview probably about 2009 in oral history with an elderly Irish immigrant who recalled the excitement. It was one of her first early memories of childhood in Athlone, I want to say, or Mullingar, when her father, who had spent time in the US, he had a visitor from New York, someone he'd known in New York when he had spent time there back in the early part of the 20th century. And that person was Monsignor McGoldrick. And it was etched in her memory as this exciting event in her childhood because, you know what it was like 80, 90, 100 years ago for a priest to visit and a priest who was in New York of all places. This was a big deal. And there she was recounting to me in 2009, you know, in a nonchalant way that this was Monsignor McGoldrick, which, you know, that place name is part of the lexicon of everyday language in Greenpoint and Williamsburg and Brooklyn, you know, but no one really thinks about the Irish connection.
Yeah, absolutely true. And I just share with you, I'm working on another piece that'll come out in the 35th journal that should be published probably in a few months. We're all familiar with the United States Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And that huge figure that sits atop the dome. And it's called Freedom. And I published this in an article on The Echo, but I'm going to publish it at more and more detail in the Roundtable Journal. That was, I'm blanking on the guy's name. This is kind of embarrassing, but anyway, the man that did it, the sculptor, Thomas Crawford. Sorry.
Oh yeah.
If you go to almost all sources on Thomas Crawford, you'll see that Thomas Crawford was born in New York. I've come across other research that he's actually not born in New York, that he was born in Ballyshannon, County Donegal. Why would he hide that? Well, he's a contemporary of the famous Bill the Butcher, right? Poole, the anti-immigrant thug, who, if you know the gangs of New York, right, he's sort of the, right. So he came to New York at a time when it was not socially acceptable to be Irish, and probably wanted to blend in. He came young enough that he wouldn't have had an accent. He became one of the first American sculptors, and he was looking for commissions from rich Americans, principally the Boston Brahmins, the Boston Bluebloods. So they were looking to promote an American sculptor, not an Irish immigrant sculptor. So I believe that he kind of buried his Irishness. It's pretty well established that he was from Ballyshannon.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Is that would he be then the person after whom the gallery in Cork is named?
I'm not sure about that, but he did the frieze on the American Capitol and then that freedom figure at the top of it.
Yeah.
So he's a vastly important sculptor, but more than that, I mean, if you think about it, the American Capitol itself, right, the artistry done in it, a lot of it was done by an Irish immigrant, which, you know, it's just, to me, that's huge.
Jeff, can I ask you, how were you always into history? Is this something you brought with you from Ireland, or how did you get into all this?
I've always been a lover of history, you know. I majored in history at Hunter College, and I taught history. I just retired after 27 years teaching history in the New York City Department of Education as a high school teacher and on different schools. But the thing I could kick myself is that probably, let's say, around the early 2000s, I became interested in local history here. And again, I have to give a shout out to John Ridge. I found an article that he wrote about the Irish history of Greenpoint, which sort of got me very interested in my own area. I've been here since the early 1990s, and I could kick myself that there were people who were alive who were in their 90s, in the 1990s, that I didn't interview, you know, didn't get them as a primary source. But, you know, if I could roll back the hands of time, I would love that. Yeah, but I actually was, there was a time when I was fascinated by Soviet history. I wanted to be a Soviet scholar, and that didn't work out, and I ended up becoming a high school teacher. But yeah, it's always been a love of mine, you know.
Is the Crawford piece what you're actively working on at the moment? Have you any other things in the pipeline? Knowing you, you do.
Well, yeah, so the Crawford piece is finished. John Ridge is putting the final touches on it. But I also wanted to mention this. I put together a book, I don't know if you can see it, The Irish in New York, which is 40 stories, or from going from really the Irish before the revolution up to the last two characters are modern day New York Irish people. My thesis is that there is so much diversity within this community that you can't just broadly say, right, this is who we are, right? That it's mind-boggling how diverse the community is. Also, I think that there's a tendency to focus on New York City. And, you know, no one loves New York more than I do. But the Irish have a huge role in New York State as well. So I wanted to focus on that as well. And places like Troy, New York, which was an industrial hub outside of Albany, was massively Irish, you know. Albany's a hugely Irish place, so I think there are also important stories that are not told.
I recall there probably in the last year or so that you were doing some work on a Father Bernard Quinn, I think his name was. Is that right?
Yeah.
That seemed like a fascinating story. Would you mind refreshing my memory on him and having the opportunity of sharing it with our listeners?
Father Bernard Quinn was an Irish American from Brooklyn who went off, was a chaplain in World War I, One of the things that horrified him is he saw a dying African American refused last rites by a Protestant minister. And when he came back to Brooklyn, he wanted to set up a church for Brooklyn's very, very large African American Catholic community. And there were a lot of roadblocks placed in his way. Unfortunately, the Catholic Church was very, very resistant to giving the African American community its own church. But he persevered and he set up St. Peter Claver Parish, and he was an absolutely loved figure. For about 20 years, he not only founded the parish, but he helped it to grow, and beloved by his African American parishioners. And I came across the story because subsequently, one of the pastors of Peter Claver was talking to the older parishioners, and they just worshiped the man, the ground that this man Quinn walked on. And he became so fascinated by him that he wrote his own book about him. He's a fascinating character who, again, breaks that kind of stereotype of the Irish being insular and not being interested in helping African Americans, you know, develop their own community here. It's an absolutely beautiful story, and he's a beautiful figure, you know. And that parish, it's still very, very, very vibrant. And what's interesting is he set up a chorus, and two of the people who sang in his chorus, you might know their names, Lena Horn and Pearl Bailey.
That's amazing.
What's also really, really tragic in the Queen story is that he acquired a piece of land, I believe in Suffolk County, so definitely on Long Island, to set up a camp for these African American kids, and twice the building was burned. You know, so the Klan was against him, and yet, you know, it's a marvelous story of really love for all of humanity, and just persevering in the face of evil and defiance, you know.
Jeff, can I ask you, have you noticed changes or developments in the trends in which people engage with New York Irish history? You know, do you feel like people are leaning more into these kind of more radical figures? Do you think that topics of race in particular have become more prominent in recent years, or has it always been there, do you think?
It's a fascinating question. First, I would say that there's a huge generational shift. If you look at Irish people who are over 50, they have a very different sets of interests and such questions that they look at Irish history. I think for younger people, racial relations are really, really fascinating. You know, it's something that it's so vital in our world. How are we all going to live together? And I think people are asking the question, well, how did our grandparents and our great grandparents and great great parents, how did they relate to people who are different than they were? And unfortunately, you know, some of the answers are super embarrassing. I mean, I can't read about the draft riots during the Civil War without a tremendous sense of shame. And John Mitchell, who was, let's say, 50 years ago, was a lionized figure. I think when people look at what he said about race, and that he was actively a proponent of the Confederacy, and then I believe, if memory, two of his sons died fighting for the Confederacy, I think it puts his biography in a completely different context. So yeah, I think that we're really looking at our history and examining, you know, those questions. I think earlier it was, okay, we strove and we made it, and what are the stories of our striving and success? I think right now, especially with the younger Irish people, success is almost kind of a given. So that more and more the question is, did we deal equitably with people? Did we treat them fairly and justly? And you have stories like Queen, you know, which it just makes me proud that Irish man was so loving and so embraced us, this community. And then you have other stories that we frankly have to be embarrassed about. So yeah, there is definitely a shift. And also I think gender wise, I think probably 60 years ago, we weren't nearly as interested in Irish women as we should be. You know, you mentioned Gertrude Kelly. Gertrude Kelly and a number of Irish activists, I don't know where the men were. The men were nowhere, but it was those Irish ladies who organized the dock strike, the first purely political strike in New York City history against British ships coming in the 1920s to New York Harbor. They really haven't gotten their due. Yeah, it's not just in terms of race, but also in terms of gender. You know, we still have a lot of work to do in examining that, you know.
So, Jeff, what's the game plan in terms of to bring us back to the New York Irish History Roundtable website? So going forward, the volumes will automatically populate then on the website?
No, I'd have to download them and scan them in, but it's, yes. But I know how to do that.
Okay. And then, so a move away from the only traditional physical gatherings and a moving more towards online, is that proving more effective?
Yeah. You know, one of the things if people could reach out to you, I would be really grateful is I really need to learn how to drive people to the site and how to market the site, because a lot of people still don't know that the site is there. And I know that there are kind of techniques that you can use for people who are web developers. So that's something that I'm looking for. I can envision a day in the near future when there will no longer be physical copies of this journal, that it will all be online, you know.
Yeah.
That day is coming very soon.
Well, I think we noticed that at Ireland House as well with the American Journal of Irish Studies that, you know, frankly, the way things are, not alone in terms of actually just the costs involved, but from an ecological point of view and access point of view, people don't really want hard copies, right? I mean, you're probably like me, I'm guessing, in that I like the hard copy. Down through the years, Jeff, I must look and see at some point when I organise all my publications, all my books and everything, I have by kind of osmosis and generosity and inheriting and dumpster diving, I have a pretty sizable collection now of the New York Irish History Roundtable Journal. I got a bunch of them. People would just, you're probably the same, people come to you and say, I have books, someone has died or someone has moved out an apartment. And so I don't think it's complete, but I've managed to over the years pick up the hard copy, and I like having the hard copy. I like to be able to pull them out, but that does not mean that just the searchability alone, Jeff, you know, I'm here playing around as I'm, you know, listening to you, like just putting in search terms, putting in names and whatever. And it's, you know, that's a game changer for us doing historical research, especially biographical research, where you're just trying to see who's written on these people in different ways, right?
Well, I have a Polish wife who every time I get a book says, my God, another book? Do you not have enough?
Now, let me ask you this, Jeff. You've been very generous with your time, but I do want to ask you, in the process of organizing the materials for this catalogue and archive, were there articles that you came across? Was there any theme or topic you came across where you just had to stop and read it, or was something, are there ones that spring to mind that you can say that just were particularly memorable in terms of like stopping you in your tracks to take a read?
Well, it's interesting because it actually led to a walking tour. So across from us here in Greenpoint, across Newtown Creek is Long Island City. Mm-hmm. And in one of the early journal articles, there was a piece about Paddy Gleason, who was the last mayor of the independent city of Long Island City. And he was just a larger than life character, a Tipperary man, one of ten children, a Civil War veteran, and that led me to leading a walking tour for the Irish Centre over in Long Island City, which was a tremendous amount of fun. One of the things I had to do, though, is I had to kind of buckle down because, yeah, I could have read every journal article, and I never would have gotten the project done. So at a certain point, I had to say, I can't delve into this.
Jeff, I know that I've done this before with you, but will you just, before we wrap up a little, you know, Greenpoint is close to my heart, and you mentioned you have a Polish wife and you're Irish. It's actually a really interesting place in terms of the study of ethnicity. I mean, New York is like that in general. But can you tell us, for people who aren't familiar, can you just give us a short snapshot of the ethnic footprint of Greenpoint? People today probably still associate it as a Polish neighbourhood, although that's been changing a lot in recent years. But tell us about Irish Greenpoint in terms of the highlights for you.
In the 1840s, Greenpoint was still farmland with only about 100 inhabitants. And a man looked across from Manhattan, and Manhattan was booming. And he said that would be a perfect place for shipbuilding. So by the 1850s, Greenpoint's waterfront was lined with shipyards. And even as early as the 1850s, about 30% of Greenpoint's population were Irish people who were shipwrights. Basically, the Irish controlled the waterfront. This was a place that never had a railhead. So everything that came in and out of this very, very prominent industrial area had to go out on ships. So the Irish controlled the waterfront. We mentioned Peter McGinnis before. He started as a stevedore. And it's really interesting. So a number of people came from Cushendall, County Antrim. And there's always been a very, very heavy Antrim presence here in Greenpoint. It was also a place of factories. It was, they called the American Birmingham. So you could really get off, the boat. If you made your way to Greenpoint, you'd get a job in a factory. A number of the factory workers here were actually female. They were huge female factories. So we had a pencil factory that was almost exclusively female. We had a light switch factory, Leviton, which was almost, again, exclusively female. So it's also really, really interesting. But that's the genesis of the Irish community.
Did I say this to you before, Jeff, on Monitor Street, where we were, that block now, which is, you know, these pretty ugly looking 1970s apartment blocks, those red bricked ones that are not very attractive at all. And they run along Meeker, along Monitor, Herbert and North Henry. My understanding that originally that site was a curtain rail factory. Would that sound about right to you?
Yeah.
Wow. And it's interesting to hear the dominance of female factory owners.
Well, not owners, workers.
They were the workers. Oh, sorry, right. I misheard you. I was saying, was Greenpoint booking the trend? Wow. That makes sense.
Sadly, part of the reason why they were hired is you could pay them less.
It wasn't that admirable. Well, listen, Jeff, it's always a treat to catch up with you. And, you know, I commend John Ridge and I commend Frank for their support in this, and Patrick Gilmore, who has a great Irish name as well. I'm thinking of Patrick Gilmore of the band fame, but also to Turlough for this great idea to, you know, find the means by which to do this. And to you, Jeff, this is a really great gift to scholarship on Irish New York and Irish America. And we owe you a great debt in that. And I'm really looking forward, and believe you me, we'll be sharing the information, through our networks. It's a wonderful, easy web address, I think, to remember. You probably deliberated on that a little bit.
Let me just share it again. So it's nyirishhistory.us. I can't sign off without. So I've got to give a shout out to Dermot Fitzpatrick from the Irish Consulate here, who was infinitely patient with me in going through the steps to actually get the grant, of helping me along the way. It was the first time I'd ever applied for a grant, and you probably have applied for many. You know, it's a complicated process. And
no, it is. And I absolutely agree with you again. Dermot has been very patient with me too in some of the managing the vagaries of NYU and the grant system and everything. But kudos to Dermot, and the Emigrant Support Program is such a wonderful support. Nice. In terms of making projects like this viable. And this is so complementary to what is done at NYU, in particular the Archives of Irish America. And I know my colleague Marion Casey will be really delighted to have seen this. And I'm really grateful that Linda Dowling-Almeida put us together on this topic, because it's so appropriate to our listeners. Jeff, thanks for coming on to This Irish American Life again. Wonderful to connect with you and to hear what you're up to, and keep at it.
All right. All the best.
Thanks,
always,
Jeff.
Always great to connect with a neighbor.
Thanks, Jeff.
Ciao.
In the springtime, the birdsong is at its strongest, and by July or August, the birdsong has mostly stopped. And it's on those mornings that you will hear mainly birds calling and doves cooing. It's really quite beautiful and somewhat out to lunch, but attractive all the same. I'm really thrilled to share with you today a recording of later summer chorus of birds, recorded on the 6th of August in Ballin Valley Woods in the southeast end of County Wicklow, near Arklow, my hometown. This was recorded by Fintan O'Brien, who is a wonderful advocate and recorder and documentarian of these wonderful sounds made by nature in the surrounds of his environment. And I'm really thrilled on this week's This Irish American Life to share with you, as we close out the program, this wonderful recording which he captured on the 6th of August. The sound quality and the sounds in general belie the preparation and energy and creativity that go into capturing such beautiful sound. So enjoy this, recorded by Fintan O'Brien. Thank you. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.